I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday evenings. I think most of you are aware of the drill. Tuesday evenings is an ongoing lecture series, and it's been, I have to say, a really fabulous series this fall. I've enjoyed every one of them, been very proud of them, and thank you to many of you because they've been incredibly well attended this season. We end next week. The finale is with Katie Siegel. Katie Siegel is a professor of art history at Hunter College in New York, probably even better known perhaps as editor-in-chief of Art Journal and contributing editor to Art Forum, also a curator. She is here to talk about Since 45, America and the Making of Contemporary Art, which she published this past spring. It's about the collision of American history and modern art, and there will be a book signing in the cafe from 5:30 to 6:30 preceding the lecture. So I invite you to get the book if you... If you'd like, we have it in the Modern store. It's available to you there. And then come by and talk to Katie before the lecture and have her sign your book. Tonight, we have the great fortune of hearing from the Modern's chief curator, Michael Opping. As always, I really appreciate Michael's willingness to participate in Tuesday evenings throughout his time here at the Modern. And I think that it's clear from his faithful followers who are here tonight that the Star Telegram was right on with its announcement in today's paper. Did anybody see that? That was pretty sweet. I thought it was sweet. It stated that Opping is a sure bet, and he is, and for a lot of reasons, we're all aware. As the paper describes, Michael is entertaining. That's one of the descriptives they used. But what we all know is that his ability to entertain is due to his vast knowledge and resulting confidence in his subject, which has brought him and subsequently this museum and this community, I have to say, international recognition and regard. Tonight's lecture, Los Angeles, Light and Space at Land's Edge, for example, is a product of the role that Michael has played in the extensive and historically significant Getty Research Institute and Foundation's $10 million initiative, Pacific Standard Time, which is a collaboration of exhibitions that opened this past month throughout Southern California as a celebration and a record of the birth of the L.A. art scene, encompassing every major L.A. art movement from 1945 to 1980. Some of you may recall, in fact, David Pagel speaking of this massive effort when he was here a few weeks ago. Thanks to Michael's scholarship and personal experience with the art of Southern California, he was sought out to serve on the advisory committee of no less than two of these major exhibitions, State of Mind, Conceptual Art in California in the 1970s, and Phenomenal Light and Space Movement in Southern California. And in addition, he was a contributing author to the book Phenomenal. As most of you will recall, Michael's recent exhibition and accompanying catalog, Ed Ruscha Road Tested, is evidence of his insight into the time frame and issues addressed in Pacific Standard Time. As our purchases, he has secured for this museum during his tenure here. While I am tempted to go on and tell you details about upcoming news, such as Michael's interview with the recently deceased Lucian Freud for the exhibition of the artist's work that opens at the National Portrait Gallery in London in February and then is the Modern Summer Exhibition, or to remind you of highlights in his illustrious career, such as winning Best Pavilion at the 1990 Venice Biennale, for the work of Jenny Holzer in the American Pavilion, for which he was the commissioner. I think some of you are aware of that fact. But Michael doesn't like long intros, so so out of respect for Michael, and after all, you guys knew what you were getting when you decided to come tonight, so please join me in welcoming Michael Opping.
Thank you very much. As a disclaimer, I want to say that I grew up in Los Angeles. And as you know, people who live in Southern California often like to talk about the fact that they grew up under a special light. Unfortunately, they did. A lot of it is luck. It has to do with longitude and latitude. But some of it has to do with context. Whoops. There's something about being at the edge of a continent and staring out across the Pacific Ocean towards Japan and looking at the light and space that makes that space and that light particularly expansive. This poster, which was produced in 1930, even the most cynical East Coast person would want to come to the West with that honey-colored space that seems to go on endlessly. And a lot of artists did come to the West Coast in the early part of the century. And many of them compared the light to the south of France and to French Impressionism. And we know that Monet painted his subjects many times and in series, not because he was so fascinated with that subject, but because he wanted to see them under different light conditions. So Monet's pictures were as much about light as they were about landscape. But the light in Southern California is different than the light in France. And it's a light that is very particular, I think, to Southern California. Not only the coastal light of looking out at the ocean, but the light of the low desert of Southern California. This is a painting from 1925 by Charles Riefel. And each of these artists who came from the East to see Southern California and paint its landscape did it in a different way. Riefel did it in a kind of super realistic manner, showing the clarity of the light in Los Angeles. Lee Mulliken was a founding member of a group called the Dynaton Group, and they were abstract painters. And this is a painting called Space, and he portrays space as a series of splintered fragments of light. And Mulliken ended up living in Santa Monica, settling in Santa Monica and in Southern California. And this is a very early attempt to get at the essence of space and light in Southern California, but through abstract painting. In 1967, Richard Diebenkorn moved to Santa Monica, the Ocean Park area of Santa Monica. And I show this photograph because it shows the window that Diebenkorn looked out of to look at the Ocean Park area. And many people talk about looking out of that window and how his paintings appear to be gridded and how the window panes obviously suggested a gridding of that landscape. What fascinates me about this photograph is not so much Diebenkorn looking out the window, but the light coming in through the window and infusing his studio with light. Many people like to look at Diebenkorn's work as sort of an aerial view of Ocean Park, just abstracted. But I think a more interesting way to look at Diebenkorn is as an attempt to create an atmospheric space. I mean, when you look at Diebenkorn's paintings, one of the things that I think keeps you looking at them is not the design aspect of these paintings, but their translucency, their attempt to create atmosphere through translucent layers of paint. Ed Ruscha's early still lifes were not presented traditionally on tables, but they were presented floating in this sort of endless space. And one might suggest that this space, in the case of this particular painting, is a smog-tinged space. And those of us who grew up in L.A. love that sort of smoggy look of Los Angeles. You grow to love it, particularly around sunset. Now, as evocative as painting can be in trying to capture light, there was another generation of artists in Los Angeles that attempted to actually use light as a part of their art, to actually use light as a physical material, as a physical part of a piece of sculpture. Now, in the 1950s in Los Angeles, there was a hub of activity, a hub of industries based around making plastics. Plastics had an unbeatable combination of flexibility, they were lightweight, and they could be transparent, and they were strong. And the airline industry developed plastics for the windows of airplanes and for various parts of airplanes. They saved millions of dollars integrating plastic into their industry. And there are a number of artists in Los Angeles who were very aware of what Boeing was doing. Craig Kaufman was one of them. Kaufman created vacuum-formed pieces of plastic that were painted and spray-painted a pearlescent color. And basically what they did was they absorbed light and captured it. So when these pink bubbles, quote-unquote, were placed on a wall, they appeared to glow like an orb. So that the plastic was absorbing the light and holding it. Now, there was also the surfing industry in Southern California, and they were experimenting with a lot of different kinds of resins and plastics in the making of surfboards. All of us who grew up in Southern California in the 60s and 50s remember using resin and fiberglass to repair our boards, my board in particular, which took a real beating. But these resins were prevalent everywhere in Southern California, even motorcycle shops, surfboards. And a number of artists, including Dwayne Valentine and Craig Kaufman and Peter Alexander, used resin to mold. And they developed very precise ways of molding resin. And what they did was they would create a sculpture that would be dense in one area and very translucent in another. And the effect was that at the bottom of the sculpture, there was a density and a weight to this piece of minimal art. But as it moved towards the top of the wedge, it disappeared. In New York, Andy Warhol referred to his studio as a factory. But in Los Angeles, you'd have to think of a lot of these studios as laboratories, where they were mixing different kinds of resins and plastics. This is Dwayne Valentine mixing resin in his studio. This is a piece by Peter Alexander called Orange Wedge. And Peter Alexander took this molding technique to another level. So it was very, very finely done. Many of these things don't exist anymore or exist in a damaged condition because the edges were so precise and so particularly formed that when they were handled, often by museums, they got chipped. The Getty Research Center and the Getty Conservation Institute is trying very hard to reconstitute some of these plastic sculptures from the 1970s. But as you can see, the bottom of the sculpture seems somewhat dense. This piece is about 8 feet tall. So at the very top of the sculpture, if you look at it against a white wall, it literally disappears. Now, probably the master, the anal retentive master of this plastic forming was Robert Irwin, and he was a patriarch in many ways of the light and space movement. And his so-called untitled discs of the late 60s and early 70s are classic examples of the light and space movement. They are approximately 5 feet across, and they consist of a very thin wafer of acrylic plastic. And it's very subtly tinged with a hue. They're placed on a wall about a foot off of the wall and lit from four sides, two from the bottom and two from the top. And the effect is that a halo is created around the plastic disc. What really happens when you look at this work is that it disappears into the wall. The edges of the form literally become a part of the wall. So the ground of the sculpture blends with the ground of the wall. What's what's really happening here is that the object is dissolving, and Irwin is using light to dissolve the object. This is Larry Bell, another one of the light and space artists, and he had to invent a vaporizing machine in order to coat his minimal glass sculptures. This is a machine that he would put glass into the machine, and it would coat it with a very, very subtle tint. And the effect was a kind of geometric piece of vapor, a colored light in a cube. It was Donald Judd vaporized. Doug Wheeler was another member of the light and space movement who hasn't really been around for a while but has resurfaced with all of these shows in Los Angeles. And I remember going to Wheeler's studio and seeing one of these in his studio. It was the only thing in the studio. And they evolved from a series of works that he called light paintings. And what you're seeing is, well, let me put this, rather than painting on canvas and then hanging the canvas on the wall, what Wheeler did was, this dark area right here is a plane that is recessed into the wall about 6 inches. Then if you were to walk up to it, though you're not usually allowed to, buried in these little channels are blue, white, neon light that then bleed out into this, recessed plane. So the entire architecture of the room is starting to be used. And this is the evolution that you'll see in the light and space movement. Jim Terrell took this a step further. He purchased a hotel in Santa Monica where Richard Diebenkorn was making his paintings. And in this hotel, there were various spaces, and he would test the amount of light that was being allowed into the space. And he would block the light, let a little light in, let a little light out. And he would just do a series of tests. In this case, it was like a Doug Wheeler painting, but using natural light. So this is a window to the hotel. Then he places a panel over the window, but leaves the edges open. And then it's essentially a real light Doug Wheeler. Now, Irwin and Terrell got involved with a psychologist named Ed Wartz in the late 1960s. And Ed worked for NASA studying the psychological effects of space travel. And what they were concerned about was people being in a tube or in a small space or in a space and in a situation where there were no specific objects to focus on. What would happen to perception if you were in a room where there wasn't anything to really look at, to say, I'm this size, I'm that size? And this is Irwin and Terrell, actually, in an anechoic chamber that NASA used. And the anechoic chamber was to deliberately eliminate sensory phenomena, so that you were only focusing on how you were feeling and thinking about things almost from a pure body standpoint. Now, I remember visiting, I apologize for this slide, but this is Robert Irwin's studio in Venice, California in the mid-1970s. And I remember visiting Irwin's studio a number of times, well, twice to be exact. And I would go, and I was very young, and I had very few questions, and my basic question was, can I see your new work? And he would say, well, it's in process. And I would be in this room, and there would be nothing in the room. And I'd say, well, I don't see anything in process. Is it in process in another room? Can we go there? He said, no, I'm really working on the studio. And basically what he would say was, you know, I designed these skylights. I built these skylights, and they're very precise to how I want this room to feel and look if I were to make something in it. He was also working on surface, on wall surfaces. So at one time I went and he had a whole wall that was a test wall that rather than just painted drywall, he had plastered it because the plaster was a softer feel. It was a different sense of how the whole room felt. The second time I went was similar to what this is, and I'm sorry you can't see it, but there is a plexiglass column in the center of the space, which I almost bumped into. It is a pure, clean plexiglass column with knife edges that when you look at it from just one particular angle, you might see it almost like a prism, but basically it disappears. And as I would drive in my Toyota Datsun from Fullerton to this studio. This was an hour drive on the 405 freeway, and I get there and I would see nothing, and I would be very frustrated. I wanted answers. This was supposed to be a smart artist, but it didn't. You know, years later, I realized that I learned a lot from those visits to Irwin's studio. They taught me how to see myself seeing. They taught me how to think about what I should be looking for. And what I had been looking for was a thing in the room, when I should have been looking at the room as the thing, looking at the edges of things. You know, that's what perception is about. Pure perception, as Irwin would call it. So when I first saw Irwin's scrim pieces, which are sort of a gauzy white theater cloth, that are used in theaters, that were stretched throughout different architectural spaces, I was prepared to understand what was going on because I was now looking at the architecture. I wasn't looking for the thing in the room. I was looking at how Irwin was dealing with the room. And the beauty of these scrim pieces was you could take a piece of architecture, and particularly in the 70s, there was a lot of very bad architecture. Many of the galleries were not nearly as beautiful as the galleries you experience today when you look at contemporary art. They were tacky in many ways. And Irwin could take the scrim and literally erase a part of the room, and then light it from the back or from the outside, and you would know that that space existed on the other side of the cloth, but you weren't really dealing with it. You know, you were dealing with Irwin's room. So Irwin, in a way, was a kind of pseudo-architect. This is a piece at the Walker Art Center in 1976. Now, the thing about the scrim pieces is, and there are some, he has redone some scrim pieces in Los Angeles this last month. Depending on the amount of light coming into the room, they can be virtually invisible. You will not even know they're there. You could walk into them. If there is more light in the room, this is a slightly exaggerated look. You can see that the back wall is aglow. But I walked into a room, and I know I walked into a room last week in Los Angeles with an Irwin scrim piece and had to be told by a museum guard that there was a scrim piece there because it was a slightly gray day. So what Irwin is doing is making you see in really precise ways, in very subtle ways. So what was happening in Southern California, obviously, as you can see at this point, is that light was not being depicted, it was not being illustrated. Light was literally being used as a component in the sculpture. And, you know, one of the great people to use light is Jim Turrell. I once asked Frank Gehry what the difference between sculpture and architecture was. And he said, those guys, meaning artists, don't have to deal with doors and windows. Well, actually, during the light and space movement, they did deal with some doors and windows, and in a very effective way. This is a piece called Sky Space, and it's dated 1972. It's at Count Giuseppe Ponza's. He was an Italian count who had some stables that he no longer used, so he converted them to artist spaces and allowed artists to come in and do works. And in this particular room, you would walk in and look up and see what you thought, particularly on a calm day, what you thought was just a blue rectangle of color. that had been painted on the ceiling. In fact, Terrell had punctured the ceiling, and what you're looking at is pure sky. No glass. Irwin's skylights had glass, and he often used filters. This was pure space. Now, to make this work, to make that sort of flip between I'm looking at a patch of blue and I understand that I'm looking at sky, the edges of the cut has to be so precise. I mean, it's just absolutely, it's really where your perception goes is really to the edge of the blue. And some of these skylights can be amazingly grand. This is a more recent skylight by Terrell. And they're very euphoric. They're often described as meditation spaces. And they are remarkably calming and remarkably sublime in a lot of ways. But let's not forget that this is a dialogue that has been going on for some time, this dialogue between architecture, light, and space. This is the Pantheon in Rome, in which a single room is only lit with natural light through one large oculus. Now, there are certain artists that are not normally associated with the light and space movement because their work is more psychological rather than purely phenomenological, and that would be Bruce Nauman. And in the late 1960s, Nauman began making a series of corridors, very narrow corridors. And then he began flooding them with light. And the light did two things. It attracted you into the space, into the corridor. But once you got about midway through it, that color began working on you. And you began feeling the whole place compress on you. And you wanted out really fast. And I don't go into these anymore. There was one in L.A. last week, and I just kept looking in at it. And they're psychologically tormenting if you have any kind of claustrophobic issues. If you go in and you get to the middle, and if two people come in to either entrance, it's a tough deal. Now, part of it had to do with the intensity of these pieces, and the irritational quality of these pieces has a lot to do with the color. And Nauman chooses very strange colors, usually acidy yellow and acidy green. And he can really crank up the irritation level on these with the yellow. And this is a piece called Standing or Left Standing. No, Standing Left or Left Standing. And it consists of a room that is a kind of a parallelogram. In other words, there is not a right angle in the room. And you enter the room, and so you're immediately thrown off by the fact that there is not a right angle. And he also ups the ante by adding text. And so before you enter the room, there's a text. And the text does not describe the room, and it doesn't tell you how to feel in the room. But it talks about, you know, leaving a vacancy, a slight physical depression, as though I had been in a vaguely uncomfortable place. Not for a long, but undetermined period, not waiting. And then he talks about small cuts on the tips of my fingers or across the backs of my hands. So what begins to happen is you're thinking about the room and you're thinking about your body. And you're thinking about vacancy, and all these things get mixed up in your head when you're in the space, all of which Nauman wants to happen. And then you get in the room, and he adds one other kicker, and that is that you enter the room and leave the room in pure, cool gallery light, like a blue-white light. When you're in the room, it is a bright fluorescent yellow. And what happens is your brain mixes the blue with the yellow and it becomes a putrid violet. Now, sometimes Bruce pumps the light up so much that he lifts a room off the floor. And although this has a humorous quality to it, when you walk into it, there is, again, a discomfort about this light and the relationship between the architecture. Can someone see my feet? Should I stand in the center of the room? I don't dare get towards the edges. It's a little like, you know, wearing a pair of pants that are too short. You know, everything is slightly off, and then the light is quite bright, and it's the light is focusing on you. It's beating down on you. Then one last piece by Bruce, which in some ways I describe as the last piece of the light and space movement, although it's not. This is a model. I don't know if you can see, but there is a little figure right there. So this is a model. And on three levels at 420 West Broadway in New York, in Soho, in 1984, Bruce used a second floor, a main floor, and a basement. And he created four tunnels. One, two, three, four. And each tunnel was closed with a grate, so you couldn't get into it. But if you look down into the tunnel at a very, very far end, you would see a vague light. Almost not there. Almost not there. And the piece was called Room With My Soul Left Out, Room That Does Not Care. And in many ways, I think that is precisely what pure phenomenology is. Bruce has left the room. He's taken his soul out. All of his expression as an artist has been taken out, ostensibly. And what you're left with is a room that doesn't care, a room that you look into. And you're placed at a crossroads in these channels with these fading lights. This probably had to be the ultimate anti-light and space movement piece. This is called Five-Day Locker Piece by Chris Burden. Now, everyone who talks about the light and space movement always focuses on the light. But you can't have light without dark. Darkness, it was a very big part of the light and space movement. And this is a piece that Chris Burden did when I was going to Cal State Fullerton. He was going to UC Irvine. As his graduate student piece, his graduating piece, he locked himself in a portfolio locker for 5 days. He had himself padlocked in. He didn't lock himself in. He had someone padlock him in. He basically had, to be clear about this, he was in this space and this space. He cut the top out of this one. He was in this and this, and there was a bucket down here so he could pee. He had 1 gallon of water, and he had himself locked in for 5 days. You would think, well, that has nothing to do with light and space. But as Chris talked about it afterwards, he said, it got so dark, it was bright. And then he said, after 2 days, you could start seeing cracks in the steel and light peeking through, just creeping through, which gave him a sense of hope that there was air coming in and that kind of thing, although these are air vents here. A very, very intense piece. One would say, in fact, I think it was a jab at the light and space movement in many ways. And it's not coincidental that Robert Irwin was teaching at UC Irvine at the time that Chris graduated. Another artist who is not well known, but who did some really interesting things as a part of this light and space movement, was an artist named Eric Orr. And he used very simple ephemeral materials to create these remarkably intense spaces. And this is a piece called Zero Mass, 1972-73. And it consists of, although this looks like there's light in the room, it consists of dark photographic paper, very large sheets of dark photographic paper, taped together probably 15 feet high, and put together in a kind of a spiral. So you walked in through the spiral and ended up in this paper chamber. Pitch black. Pitch black. And nothing to hold on to. A lot of these things got torn up because people basically went berserk in them. But if you waited 10 minutes. Light, and usually he used very little available light. There was no illumination inside of this chamber. It would be the light that would be in the outside room. And he preferred one simple window with moonlight, which would take a very long period of time to literally soak through the paper. But once the light soaked through the paper, you began to see all kinds of things. Maria Nordman is someone who has insisted we not acknowledge her. She doesn't want to be a part of any movement. But for me, she was one of the most important people of the light and space movement. She did a number of things that very few people saw. I was fortunate to see most of them. And this is the storefront of her studio on Pico Boulevard in Los Angeles. And she also began, like Terrell, by blocking out sections of glass that fronted her studio. And in sometimes you would go to her studio and one side of the studio would be pure light and one side would be pure black. And you would just be asked to walk between the light and the black. She was tough, Maria. You would go to her studio and she would say, "You should go into this," she had a German accent, "go into this little hole and go in the room and stay for 20 minutes minimum." And the room was pitch black. And you're going through a little rabbit's hole, basically. The hole was about this high. And you would crawl in, and I did this twice, actually, and would wait. 10 minutes, nothing. 15 minutes, I don't know. What am I? Am I seeing anything? And I kept questioning what I'm seeing, what I'm not seeing, which is really what these so-called immersion pieces are all about. You're immersed in a situation where your senses are tested. You know, am I making this up, or am I actually seeing something? And you could be in this room, in this dark, dark room, looking around. And eventually, in the case of Maria, something would happen. All of a sudden, a leakage would occur. It was there all along, but it took your eyes at least 20 minutes to adjust. And it would be like a wall that has light on it. And it was a wall that you didn't even know you were in the room with. And so it was a very abstract experience. It wasn't surreal at all. It was very phenomenological, which is what all of these artists were interested in. Now, I often ask Maria what her influences were, what artists, you know, inspired her, that kind of thing. Never mentioned a single artist, never once. But she did mention that she had worked as an assistant for Richard Neutra, a Los Angeles architect. And Neutra's contribution, I think, has to do with creating a completely porous sense of architecture. In Southern California, because the climate is so mild and the light is so beautiful, there was this sense in Neutra's mind that the space of the room and the space outside of the room should be continuous. That you shouldn't need to have these big walls that protected you like you did, you know, in more severe climates. So he was the master of the glass wall and the master of the sliding glass door. And it occurred to me that that's what Maria's work is about. It's about porousness. It's about creating this continuousness, this leakage between an outside space and an inside space, and using light to create that continuousness. One of the most incredible pieces that some people saw, some people didn't see, was a piece Maria did at Saddleback College, and it was called Saddleback Mountain. And it consisted of, if I can explain this to you, oops, it's not working. Okay, there we are. This is the entrance right here, and it's pinched. So basically one person could enter at a time, and only one person was allowed to enter at a time. And then as you entered, you walked down this channel towards this mirror. As you're walking, let me see if I can, okay. So this is the entrance. As you're walking down towards this mirror, light is also entering the channel. So you're, in a sense, being carried by the light. Now, as you get towards the mirror, the light hits the mirror and it flashes into a larger room that you turn left into. And depending on when you get there or how long you stay would depend on how much light you see in that larger room. So you can see the mirror here and you can see the light leaking in, right? At a certain point in time, boom, you're in the room and it was literally a wall of light. I thought of it like a glass wall, except it was made of light. And one side of the room would be very light, and one side of the room would be very dark. But at other times, there would simply be this precise, drawn line of light flashing through the center of the gallery, and that was the piece. When I worked at the University Art Museum in Berkeley, we invited Maria to do a piece. And she is very, very precise and extremely demanding. Our building was a building designed by Mario Ciampi, and it was in the brutalist 60s, 70s style of poured-in-place concrete, the opposite of a Tadao-Ando poured-in-place concrete building. Very, very brutal. And Maria did a piece which was called 6/21/79, which is a date. And it was the date of the summer solstice in 1979. The piece was to be a one-day piece, a 24-hour piece, in which the museum would be open from the break of dawn until the 24 hours the next day. The summer solstice, of course, is the longest day of light in the year. Winter solstice being the shortest light of the year. So Maria wanted the longest day of light and for the museum to be open. There was another kicker. All of the art and all of the objects had to be removed from the building. Every single piece. So the museum was empty. Let me see. And we opened at daybreak. And towards midday, light began entering the room, almost like an audience coming in. Now, one other thing. She had placed on the ground floor, she had put a very bright white plastic, adhered it to the floor of the museum, so that when the light came in, you could track it very carefully. You could see it flash up. And then, at the end of the day, the next day, the museum closed, and that was the piece, 24 hours. And it reminds me, you know, again, looking out of Richard Diebenkorn's studio, you know, sometimes the light seems like it's practically nothing, but sometimes the light is absolutely everything. Thank you for coming. I'm happy to answer a few questions, if you have them. No? Oh, go ahead.
Where does Dan Flavin fit into all this?
Well, that's a good question. Dan Flavin was really about the mechanism of the light tube. I mean, he was a pure sculptor in many ways. And, you know, he was very interested in the tube itself being the art. It did have light, and that was important. And there is a, we had a huge debate at this panel discussion I was on in California last week about Flavin's light bulbs. And just briefly, I'll say, they don't exist anymore. At one time, the 6-foot standard fluorescent bulb was ubiquitous. You could get it in any hardware store. Well, now you can't. You can't get it anywhere. They have to be specially fabricated. And they're specially fabricating them, the Flavin Foundation, in a way that is not really consistent with the original bulb. And so I was asked, you know, well, what do you do? And I said, I think what Flavin would like is that when the bulb burns out, just show the bulb as sculpture. That's it. There was a life to the bulb. It existed. It's gone. There are no more of them. You know, people, you could have a photograph next to it with an explanation that this is the piece. It began at this date, and it was, you know, the lights went out at this date. So anyway, if you understand what I'm saying, he really saw himself as a sculptor, not just as... It wasn't as much about the light, and it was a more mechanical light.
I hate when my heart burns out.
Yeah.
You know, I would say there's a phenomenon I would imagine, mainly Hispanic car culture, and I imagine it's likely to originate in Los Angeles as any other Hispanic center, of mounting fluorescent neon tubes underneath the undercarriage of your car, and then driving around. I mean, obviously, it's a nighttime phenomenon in which the car seems to float on a cushion of this light. Are you familiar with those things?
I know of it. I've never seen one, actually, and it would have happened later. You know, having that on the undercarriage is tricky because, you know, for my generation, the lowriders, I mean, they rode really low, and you could never keep that bulb glowing. But I know of it, and I'm sure, that has something to do with this. I mean, those automobiles and motorcycles and surfboards and Boeing, all of that led into what artists in Los Angeles, how they made what they made, the materials they started to use. That all of that was going on in a parallel way at the time these guys, and some of it before. Big Daddy Roth's motorcycles. Craig Kaufman was very interested in the gas tanks. You see that bubble. He was very interested in the gas tanks of cherried out motorcycles.
Sure, Barry. I think it's very appropriate that you are here at this particular time here in Fort Worth, because this, some people from that may remember from the mid-70s when this museum did several exhibitions just up the hill that had an Eric Orr room.
That's right.
Larry Bell's sculpture was here. You know, several of those people came to town. It was a very interesting time, and we were sort of looking west, and that you were here. I think we're very lucky that you were here bringing it back to us.
Well, I really appreciate you bringing that up. It's really important to the history of this institution. The Fort Worth Art Museum did major pieces by Maria Nordman, Robert Irwin, Dan Flavin, Eric Orr. Help me, there are more. I mean, it was amazing how Fort Worth was smart enough at a certain point in time, we're talking about 1972 to probably 78, Fort Worth was smart enough to look west. Everybody was looking east. You know, Richard Serra, Donald Judd, New York Minimalism. Fort Worth had a series of directors who looked west. They saw what was going on, and Barry was here. That's a really good point. I should have brought that up.
Robert Irwin was very memorable, sort of, really changed my life.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. Yes?
Are there any younger artists working today that you think are having an intimate conversation with this work from the 1970s?
I do. Some of them virtually ripping it off, and some of them actually reinventing this kind of a genre. I mean, the person who comes immediately to mind is Doug Aitken. Doug Aitken is sort of an amalgamation. He's using aspects of Ruscha and aspects of Irwin, and he's created this one piece in I think it's South America that is all about light and space. And he's very aware of, and he's a surfer, he's very aware of that history of the light and space movement in Southern California. I don't know whether you consider him young. I don't know how old he is. He's probably 45.
That's young.
Okay, good. I think so. And I'm trying to think of others. I know that, you know, there are a lot of younger artists. Part of this whole Getty initiative is a $10 million project to sort of dig up this history of Los Angeles art, is to get younger artists interested in the history of that city and what took place. L.A. had a bad rap when I was working there because, you know, there was so much going on in New York. You know, New York minimalism, yeah, abstract expressionism, pop art, minimalism, conceptualism, and L.A. never had a true history of painting. I mean, remember, Diebenkorn didn't get there until 1967, and while there were other artists painting in Los Angeles, the knock was, well, they don't really understand art history, blah, 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 blah. And so they didn't, even though Art Forum started in California, moved from San Francisco to L.A. and then was shipped off to New York, but the downside was that L.A. never got the publicity of what was going on and had the market activity of what was going on in New York. The upside was the L.A. artists had nothing to lose. There was nobody looking, nobody buying. Why would Robert Irwin have an undergraduate student from Cal State Fullerton visit his studio? Obviously, nobody was coming. If he let me in. So, I think there was a sense of experimentation going on there. And you can say that about any regional area. The downside is, no, you don't get all the attention. Upside is, do what you want. You know, figure it out. Well, go ahead, Terry.
Could you just talk about what happens with an Irwin piece that's made specifically for an architectural space? I'm thinking of, for example, the piece that was in the stairway of the old building, of the old museum.
It doesn't exist anymore. And so, I mean, one of the reasons I was invited out for this Getty project, because I was sort of the last man standing. I was old. A lot of these pieces don't exist, and very few people saw them. They wanted a witness, basically, is what they wanted. Not an intellectual. They wanted a witness. And I went there to witness and say, yes, that did exist, and this is sort of what it looked like. Or this is what I think it looked like. I'm not sure. A lot of these pieces don't exist, and they're not being remade because the artists don't want them remade. And at the time, one of the reasons some of my slides are so poor, very few of these artists ever allowed their works to be photographed. Because the idea of phenomenology is that it's first-person consciousness. A photograph is an abstraction. It's not the thing. It's not what you're seeing. So to photograph it is to simply misrepresent it. So Irwin forbade photographs of any of his paintings for about a 10-year period, forbade photographs of any of his paintings, any of his installations. Same with Maria Nordman. Same with Eric Orr. So a lot of this stuff doesn't exist, and that's why sometimes I refer to it as performative architecture. It's architecture as performance.
I'll make it quick. Okay. Along the lines of pieces that are disappearing and other forces sort of interrupting a piece like the James Turrell piece in Dallas, the perspective is now being interrupted by a building. Do you see it the same way that you see the Dan Flavin piece where the bulb is out and the piece still exists?
No, I actually think in the case of the Terrell, the piece is almost ruined by that. You know, it's not, you know, to look up out of the window of a Terrell piece and see the side of a building, then all is lost. all is lost. The whole point is to look up and not quite know what you're looking at. You know, the whole idea of the Wheeler pieces and of many of Terrell's pieces was to create what they called a Gans field, an empty field, you know, that you inhabit with your perception. As soon as you put something there to relate to, the Gans field is destroyed. So I think it's different than a Flavin. And then one last question. Yes, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to ask regarding the phenomenal object of light perception from either infrared and or an ultraviolet, just on the edge, but not quite where it can be perceived. Has that been attempted by anyone?
Well, a light that can almost not be perceived.
That's right.
Just on the edge of it? Well, yeah, I'm sure. These guys did everything they could. I mean, I don't know about the... that I don't know about. You're talking about an artificial light source that is almost not visible.
Right.
I don't know any artists that have done that. And it doesn't sound like it would be practical for industrial reasons. But so I don't know. They have done it as Maria Nordman did and Eric Orr. They did it with natural light on the very edge of brilliance.
You can perceive it. It's just the retina is not going to.
Exactly. Until it adjusts.
Monochromatic.
Yeah, until it adjusts. So, well, thank you all for coming.